With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the very first episode of the Female Gaze Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse Katz, and I am joined today by Alana Rodriguez.
Hi.
Hello. Alana will be a regular co-host and contributor to this podcast. How's it going?
It's going fantastic.
Yeah.
Having a great day.
Good.
Jesse and I have been together for the past 48 hours straight.
So. True. Talking about all things female gaze.
Yep. A lot of female shit.
Yeah. So in just a few minutes, we will be joined by author Camille Perry, our very first guest, whose latest novel, When Katie Met Cassidy, has helped ring in what many have called the return of the rom-com.
Ooh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which we can debate whether or not that's even a real thing, but it's certainly something that people have been saying since the summer when Crazy Rich Asians came out and All the Boys I've Loved Before. So Camille wrote a book that is a rom-com, but not any old rom-com, because it features two women in a relationship, which is hard to come by, sadly, and gives us lots of things to talk about in terms of what the female gaze looks like in the rom-com genre. And Camille also is going to talk to us about her hot takes on classic rom-coms like the works of Nora Ephron. Maybe we'll get into Woody Allen. We'll see if we want to wade into those tricky waters. And also, this doesn't exactly count as a rom-com, I don't think. Well, we'll talk about that too. But what we all think about Star is Born, the movie on everyone's minds and lips and Spotify playlists lately. So we'll get to Camille in just a second. But first, since this is the first episode of the Female Gaze Podcast, what does the female gaze mean exactly? What are we trying to figure out on this pod? Why have we given up our precious free time to talk about it every waking minute, because that's what we're going to be doing. Okay, so the female gaze. Well, let's start with this. Some of you may be familiar with the term the male gaze, which is something that I remember studying in college many moons ago. But I'll be very honest. I didn't take it totally seriously at the time. In the ye olde days of the early to mid-aughts, when not everyone called themselves a capital F feminist,
right,
it felt a little bit forced to sit in a class and analyze films where our professor was constantly saying, look at this candlestick in the background. This is phallic imagery. This is the male gaze. These male directors are forcing this down our throats. And we kind of didn't want to hear it, some of us, and didn't want to choose to kind of accept that gaze was being forced on us in all of the films and books and art that we were consuming. But as I have grown up and come to consume more art and culture and analyze it and learn how to look at things with a more analytical eye, and as I've myself started to make films and write, etc., I've become painfully aware that the male gaze does exist everywhere.
Right.
And it's not just because it's mostly men creating things, although that is a big part of it. It's also because even women who are creating have grown up with the male gaze, so you kind of can't help but regurgitate what you've taken in your whole life.
And you also don't realize, right? Like, I feel like
yeah,
in the very
totally
beginning,
unconsciously.
Exactly, when you and I first started talking about this, I was like, God damn, this is a real thing. Like,
yes.
You have so many feelings growing up, when you're, whether it's like magazines or TV, movies, right? And you have like an issue like inside. You're like, why do I feel so like disgusted by this?
Right.
Right. And then it's like,
or unmoved
or
by
unmoved.
It. Or the opposite. I have no feelings because somehow it's not connecting.
Right. Exactly. And then finally someone says, okay, well, male gaze versus female gaze. And you're like, well, that fucking makes sense.
Right.
And now it's all you think about.
It's something that once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
And that's part of why I wanted to start this podcast, because now I see it in all things.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, I can't stop seeing it and thinking about it. And so now I need to talk about it.
Well, and not enough people talk about it.
And not enough people talk about it. And it's actually detrimental to our culture, the way that we raise our children. Like, we'll get into all of this. This is going to be a conversation that will never end.
I'm already feeling heated in the inside. I'm already
feeling
that passion. Yeah.
That's right. So I just want to mention, so the male gaze is a term that was coined by Laura Mulvey, who is a feminist film theorist from Britain. She wrote an essay in 1975 called Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema, where she pretty much for the first time defined this term. There's one quote from it, which is, "The gender power asymmetry is a controlling force in cinema and constructed for the pleasure of the male viewer, which is deeply rooted in patriarchal ideologies and discourses."
That's
which
a
is
you wanna explain that?
A lot of academic talk. For basically, I think what she's saying is that there is an imbalance in the content itself and who is creating the content and who it's being created for. And it's kind of tied into the general patriarchy that we live in, which is another word that will come up a lot on this podcast and how we're toppling it. Okay, so, and Laura Mulvey, someone that I, again, was taught in this gender studies class in college, took it in, kind of discarded it. And I'm like, I'm saying that to throw myself under the bus. I was stupid and naive. Then Jill Soloway gave a speech at the Toronto Film Festival in 2016 that finally made it all click for me. Jill Soloway is, of course, most well known as the showrunner who created Transparent. And in this speech, Jill attempted, for the first time to my knowledge, to publicly define the female gaze. The speech is still on YouTube, and I urge everyone to watch it because Jill makes a really strong argument for why the female gaze is so important. And even if you have complicated feelings about Jill themselves, because I know many of you do, and we will certainly get into all of that at some point, I still think the speech is super helpful in defining the female gaze as more than just the opposite of the male gaze. The female gaze, as Jill talks about, is directing with emotion, with empathy, depicting women and other traditionally marginalized people as three-dimensional humans with their own desires, their own needs, their own agency, not just props to serve the story of the straight cis man, and not just for the viewing pleasure of men either. Treating women as complicated people who are not just the virgin or the whore, the Carrie or the Miranda or the Samantha or the Charlotte. We are all of them. And there's one quote in particular from the speech that I really love, which is this. "The female gaze seeks to destroy all gazes. She is other gaze, queer gaze, trans gaze, intersectional gaze." Now, Alana and I personally check off a couple of those boxes.
Do we?
I mean, I shouldn't speak
for
you. I shouldn't speak for you.
No, yeah, we do. We do.
Didn't mean to out you.
I'm outed.
We will be bringing guests on this podcast who do represent the full rainbow of gazes because representation is a fucking rainbow.
That's right.
So that's what we aim to give you guys on the show.
Yeah. We want to talk about all of the things with all of the people. We don't want it to just be narrow-minded, and we don't want it to be like the same kind of conversation that we are used to hearing in general in life, you know, in media. So I think just to Jesse's point, it's about every other gaze that is not perhaps the cis male gaze.
Camille's our first guest today. Every episode we'll have on a guest who has either created something or operates in a world that we want to put a spotlight on that particular episode, thought leaders, thinkers, writers.
And also, we just want to talk about important shit, right? At the end of the day, it's not like we're here as the all-knowing duo that's going to talk about everything female gazey because we know about it.
Right.
We don't, right? It's just, there's not enough people talking about it.
Yeah. So if you hear us misspeak, if you hear us speak out of a place of privilege that you don't think we're even aware of, if we're missing something, luckily, we have something called social media.
Yeah.
We have a Twitter account, Instagram account, and also importantly, we have our iTunes page. You can go to any of those places and let us know what you love and what we've fucked up about.
Yeah, slide in the DMs.
Yeah, tell us. We have no egos about this. We really just want to be part of the conversation, which means that we are two people in a sea of millions of people who are also talking about this.
Exactly.
So, yes, we have the microphones, but you have the power to help us shape this conversation. And like, honestly, guys, we just think it's really fucking important because representation is everything.
Yeah.
And like, I think Alana and I both feel like if we had grown up seeing more of ourselves reflected back to us in the culture, it would have changed our lives.
Yeah.
I would have wasted so much less time trying to be something that I was not. And it like hurts me to think about the younger me that was taught like, okay, you want to direct a movie? You have to be like Scorsese. Watch every Scorsese film and then like try to figure out how to get to that. And it's like, well, no fucking wonder I never became Scorsese because I don't want to make that shit. Right. That's not the world that I see. It's not how I see things. It's not how I create things. Yeah. So we need to make more stuff that reflects back more people so that they can understand themselves.
Yeah, I'll speak for myself, but assuming you too, growing up, like who as a woman was someone that you truly looked up to, that looked like you, thought like you, paved a way for you?
Yeah.
Right? Like, no one.
None.
For me. I don't fucking know. I'm trying to think. I'm like, I have no idea. There wasn't even a Disney character that looked like me.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
Whatever. It's garbage. But I think now it's just so important because along the lines of education and being inclusive and just wanting to talk, mm-hmm. we need to set an example for the kids who are growing up in a fucking society that is so fucked up in so many ways sometimes. And kids now more than ever, especially with social media, with everything that they have at their disposal, it's even more important for them to have people to look up to.
Totally.
To talk with.
Yeah.
To see that are like them.
Yeah. Because sometimes you don't know who you are until you see it in somebody else.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the tools to identify. Yeah. You don't have the language. You don't have the symbols.
Yeah.
You know?
And if you know who you are, sometimes you don't know if that's okay.
Right. You think I'm the only one.
Yeah. Like, I remember, and this is going off a fucking tangent now.
Do it.
But I remember being in Africa growing up, and it was like either a babysitter or someone. She was in a swimsuit and took us to the pool. And I remember going under the water, and I saw her, and I was like, oh, my God, like, she is so beautiful. But I didn't understand, you know what I mean? I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until fucking college where I was like, I want to fuck some girls. Like, what?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Totally.
Because it's just like there was nothing for us.
Right.
And the feelings and the person I knew I was, I just didn't know if that was okay.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. I think you and I will probably repeatedly mention what our gay roots were on this podcast.
Gay
I have a feeling
roots.
It's going to come up a lot.
Yeah.
But even just to broaden this out for a second, something I just remembered going into the studio today was the stat that I once heard reported by the Gina Davis Institute. And we should actually really try to have someone from that organization on the show because the statistics they have are like really informative and frightening and so thus motivational. But they figured out a few years ago, they did a study, they analyzed the background characters. So we're not even talking about the protagonists, right? We all know there aren't enough women protagonists,
right.
Queer protagonists, people of color, all
right.
that. But the background people who don't have a speaking part, who don't have a name, in live action and animated family films, so films for kids, 17% of those background characters were women. So let me remind you, this includes animated films. This is not even like whatever possible excuse a studio could come up with of like, well, more men came to cast this background. Or I don't know what excuse they even have. But this is like a choice of an animator drawing a crowd of people in a cartoon. It's still 83% male.
And it was for family content.
Yeah,
right?
This is specifically for kids. So it makes me think of like Beauty and the Beast, like Belle is, you know, walking through town and singing about how she loves fucking books or whatever. Like, it's only men that are in this town.
Right.
What? And like, what subliminal message are you giving to kids who are watching that? And it's like, women literally don't exist in the world.
Right.
We just like don't even deserve to be out of the house.
Yeah. And if we're coming out with our little fucking books, prancing around, it's a show.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
We're singing about it. Like,
and very controversial if you read a book and you're a woman. And
you're
in a beast. Anyway.
You read?
Yeah, you read.
Oh.
No. I don't want to fuck you because you read. You have to go fuck a beast in
go
a castle.
Fuck a beast. That's not
normal. I'm sure, we could have a whole episode about that movie.
Beastie.
Anyway. Thank you guys for listening to this show. We hope that you will stick along with us for the ride because it is going to be a ride. We hope to introduce you to a lot of cool shit in the culture and a lot of exciting personalities that then you can follow because, like we said, we're not the smartest people at this. We're not the best people at this. Right. We just want to be like the hosts of this salon of thinkers who are going to come in and hang out and teach us.
Yeah.
I like
that you said salon.
It's a salon.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. All right, so I don't know. I guess that...
You guys are going to love Camille.
Yes.
Her book, I read in... I bumped
Record
into people on the
street.
Yeah, it was less than 48 hours.
Yeah.
Bumped into people on the street because I was holding it in public. It's just, if you haven't read it, you have to. This is just, we're really excited for you guys to listen to this episode today.
Okay, I guess let's get to our first guest on the Female Gaze podcast, Camille Perry.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, Camille.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you.
This is so exciting. You are our very first guest on the Female Gaze podcast. Wow, it's all happening.
It's all real. We're so excited.
I'm very excited.
When this podcast was just a little baby germ of a dream in my brain, I was talking to the friend who introduced us, Coco Lloyd, who also did the kick-ass artwork for this podcast. So if you guys like that logo...
Give us a thumbs up.
Yeah. And also shout out Coco, who designed it. Yeah. And we hope to eventually have merch. I'm thinking like trucker hats.
Horny for impeachment.
Horny for impeachment. Yes. All the things relating to everything that we're excited about, like impeachment. But anyway, so I had told Coco about how I wanted to do this podcast. And one of the first reactions she had was that I needed to meet you.
Hmm.
So then we all met.
And here we are.
And here we are, just a few months later.
We manifested it.
Yeah.
We manifested Coco's dream.
Yeah, exactly. So you are my newest best friend and someone I like to brag about knowing. And because you had, just put out the book When Katie Met Cassidy right before we met.
Yeah,
like,
just about.
It was in the same month,
yep.
I think. And I think I... Sped read, is that how you say it? Sped read it?
Yeah, sped read. I read it just about 24 hours.
Oh my God.
Jesse was like, here's a book, you have to read it. I was literally bumping into people on the street, missing stops on the path. I was like, I have to finish this fucking book. And then I finished it and I was like, record time, speed read.
In fact, I'm pretty sure I caught you in a lie. I think you pretended to have started it before you did because you were like, oh yeah, like I started it, but I haven't finished it yet.
I said, I haven't started it yet. And I was waiting for the weekend to be over. Remember? Because I left it at work, and then you were like, you have to start it.
Right. Okay.
So I was like,
and I promise you it would be fast because you can't put it down.
She goes, it's going to take you... No, she goes, we need to figure out when we're going to record this podcast, so let me know how long you think it'll take to read this book. And I was like, probably like 2 weeks, if I'm honest, you know. And she was like, trust me, it'll be faster. And then it was like 24 hours, and here we are.
It's a quickie.
Yeah.
It's a quickie.
It is a quickie.
It's quickie. I feel like I'm ready for my reread.
Okay.
Like it's about. I mean, I did a little preparing for you to come on the pod because I was thinking about what we were going to talk about and what part I might ask you to share, which we'll get to in a little bit. Anyway, for those who aren't familiar yet, would you mind giving the little plot blurb to our audience?
Sure. When Katie Met Cassidy is a romantic comedy.
Woo!
I call it a romantic comedy about gender and sexuality.
Oh.
The reason I describe it that way is because it takes generally what everyone is familiar with the rom-com genre, those standard beats of meet, lose, get. It's very conventionally plotted. However, I riff on that in a queer way.
Yeah, baby.
So that's sort of what I'm going for here.
Yeah.
Was that the first book of its kind for the LGBT community?
I wouldn't dare say that. however, the fact that it came out on a Penguin Random House put this book out, so a mainstream platform. There's not a lot of that. There's a lot of self-publishing and smaller imprints, and there's loads of queer material out there.
Yeah,
there isn't loads of queer material that's readily accessible to mainstream audiences, and that was really the goal here, was to write this story in such a way that it would apply to queer and straight audiences alike.
Okay, you just said so much that I already have so many questions about. So I feel like the book has gotten a lot of amazing press, and amazing in the sense that people are loving it, and also it's just appeared on a lot of lists, right? Especially during the summer, a lot of must-read lists. Do you think part of that was helped by the fact that it was published by such a big named publisher?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, this is my second book. My first book, The Assistants, also came out on Putnam Penguin Random House. And, you know, that book came out in hardcover in 2016. The paperback came out in 2017. And then When Katie Met Cassidy came out in 2018. So we were riding a bit of the momentum from the first book. And
right.
I think that certainly helped.
Uh-huh.
It also could have backfired if people really, really hated this book. Because then, I mean, second books are notoriously, totally. You get that sophomore slump where you may not get so much media attention.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing that really, really helped was that the book came out in June, which is Pride Month.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So there were a lot of tie-ins there,
right?
Which were really fun and I think got us a little bit of good press.
Yeah. Are you just a very fast writer? Like, when did you write The Assistants versus When Katie Met Cassidy? How did they come out so closely to each other?
Well, The Assistants... I mean, The Assistants was pretty much done long before it came out because it was a first book. There was a really long media buildup.
Uh-huh.
So I had almost like 2 years from the point at which like I knew that book had sold to when
it was on shelves.
I was already working on When Katie Met Cassidy
at
that
crazy.
Point.
Got it. Okay, so you gave a very pretty description of the plot of the book, but that wasn't really like
the plot.
Okay.
Yeah, I realized I didn't. So the plot...
Get in
basically,
there.
So
give it to us.
You've got Katie, who is she's, you know, pretty much a good girl. She's born and raised in Kentucky to conservative parents. Pretty, she grew up with religion.
Uh-huh.
The thing about Katie is she's really not someone who ever would have imagined that she's someone who would fall in love with another woman.
Mm-hmm.
She's fairly conventional. She's not like a prude or anything like that, but. She's, you know, she's not someone who I think would ever see herself with another woman, especially a woman like Cassidy, who is not just female, but also a very masculine presenting female.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in a lot of ways, even someone in this day and age like Katie, who grew up sort of conventionally, may totally be okay emotionally with being like, huh, maybe I'm gay. Maybe I like women. Maybe I want to have sex with this woman.
Yeah.
But the fact that Cassidy's also so genderqueer just adds a little bit of gravitas to it.
Mm-hmm.
Cassidy is basically Katie's polar opposite. She's born and bred New Yorker. She is out and proud. She never met, like, a bespoke suit that she didn't love.
Yeah.
When they first meet, Katie actually mistakes Cassidy for a man, briefly. So... it's not that Cassidy is trying to pass, but she's easily mistaken for a man on first look,
mm-hmm.
which Katie does sort of on first look mistake her for a man. But then they encounter one another again. There are sort of two meet cutes in this book, because why only have one meet cute when you have two meet cutes?
Everyone loves one. so why not love two?
Their first one doesn't go so well. Their second one goes better. And then they sort of become fast friends from there. And then it evolves.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, so I have questions about the decisions that you made about everything you've just described. First of all, why did you decide to write a rom-com?
I knew I wanted to write a rom-com for a lot of reasons.
Uh-huh.
One thing that's sort of funny is as we sit here now, right here today, and
uh-huh.
like when this airs, the rom-com is like in the middle of a resurgence. Like,
yeah.
But when I started this book and knew I wanted to write a rom-com, the genre of rom-com was sort of like a throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one was making rom-coms. No one was, you know.
Do you agree that it's in a resurgence? Or is that just something we're saying because we had like... two films this summer that...
Well, then wouldn't that be a resurgence
well?
I think it is. There's Think Pieces on it. There's, I mean...
Math.
People...
The two is more than zero.
That's right.
Yeah. But does two qualify as a resurgence? I don't know. Anyway,
I think
yes.
there's more than two.
Okay.
I think there's more than two. I think there's many more than two. Many of them are on Netflix and people are just watching them over and over and over again.
Right.
Like,
yeah, when did Duck Butter come out? That's a romance.
Okay.
It's not a rom-com, but...
Well, okay. I laughed because I'm thinking of like
you're thinking
to all
like
the boys
when
I
Harry
loved
met
before.
Sally.
No, the recent one.
Oh, the
Step
recent
it
ones.
Up to all the boys I loved before. Yeah.
Which one's Step It Up?
Step It Up is it an is a Netflix original?
Set It Up.
Set It Up. Oh my God, I combined.
You Channing Tatum on your mind.
Yes, I clearly do.
I was like, you guys are talking about old movies. What conversation
Yeah. I got lost in the sauce. I was just thinking just romance.
Set It Up.
Set it up
is not Step It Up, an essential distinction I was neglecting.
Set It Up, you're right. Set It Up might have kicked off the resurgence.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway. So when you were thinking about writing the book, this hadn't started yet, and you were missing the rom-com? So you thought,
like,
why don't I bring it
back? I felt like it was a... No, I didn't... I'm not that full of myself.
bring it
way
back.
More humble than she
I'm bringing yeah, sexy back.
Ooh! No. You did with this book.
JT already did that for us. I always knew I wanted to write a queer story.
That was my second question. Why a queer rom-com?
Right.
Yeah.
I had tried writing queer stories long, long, long before I even came up with the idea for The Assistants, which was my first novel. I tried writing short stories and all different sorts of things, playing with form, and I just could never really get it quite right. And then The Assistants happened, and I put all my other queer story ideas aside, and then when I knew, you know, it was time to sort of think up a new book, I would just went back to a lot of that old material.
Mm-hmm.
But having had the years of experience of writing a whole nother novel, I cracked the code a bit and I figured out the package. Figured out the plot. I figured out that I was overthinking it.
Uh-huh.
And what I really wanted to do was write a really conventionally structured story so that it could free me up to kind of riff on all of these other things.
Yeah.
And that's what I really liked about the rom-com is that you know what you're going to get going into it.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of frees you up to play on that and queer
right.
that up
yeah.
in like endless different ways.
Totally.
So besides the fact that the characters are queer, what else do you feel like you were trying to subvert in the rom-com genre? Or was that really it? Was that enough? Was, like, the structure kind of the Trojan horse of then exposing people to queer characters that they've never seen featured in a rom-com before?
It was kind of a dance for me. Two things were going on simultaneously. One, I knew I wanted to write a book that was subversive, as you say, but I also wanted to write a book that would resonate with people who maybe don't think so much about even the meaning of the word subversive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So because this was coming out on my publisher, I wanted my fans from my other book to be able to come to this and have it be accessible mm-hmm. and have them fall into the story
mm-hmm.
and get swept away by what it is on its surface, which is a fun, fast-paced,
yeah.
romantic story. So this book... Depending on what you bring to the table,
uh-huh.
you're going to experience it very differently. Like when I talked about this book in a room full of librarians who are predominantly, you know, middle-aged women from the tri-state area, I talked about it very differently than I would if I was going into like an NYU gender studies class with a bunch of kids who were studying Judith Butler. You know,
right?
So the dance I had with this book was I wanted it to function as both, and I didn't want to alienate anyone, and that
right.
was really hard to pull off. I think that was the biggest challenge with this book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's so important and valuable because so often this kind of content that we create, and by we I mean like. People like us in this room, right? Like
creators,
but also like queer women, liberals,
yeah.
like,
yeah.
you know, we are in the community. We know the community. We're interested in the content that's about the community. But at a certain point, you're preaching to the choir.
Right.
If you're only telling stories where like you have to have a certain life or perspective to even understand like the entry point into that world and not immediately be put off by it.
Absolutely.
And then who are you really teaching?
Right.
I mean, I also think
can't
it's important
preach to the choir.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, I guess my point is we need all of it.
Yeah.
We need the stuff that is
of course.
Explicitly for the community and then also things like this where you're really opening a door that is rarely opened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted it to be inclusive, not exclusive.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, we could like, I didn't want to put any jargon in this book. I didn't want anyone to have a fancy, you know, gender background to be able to like get some of the stuff in this book. There's like those Easter eggs in there for people who are looking for it.
Uh-huh.
But you don't need it.
I mean, should we talk about the Cassidy gender thing?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Cause I also want
to talk about the Katie.
We'll get to that too.
Yeah.
Well,
let me know.
Because it's just, no. But because of what Camille just said, I feel like let's start with Cassidy.
Yeah.
That I think, you know, when I was first reading the book, and Alana, tell me if you had the same experience, when you first read the description of Cassidy, who Katie at first thinks is a man, and then you realize it's a woman, and then it's a queer woman, and you're like, oh, I wonder if this character is
non-binary.
Non-binary. Because in this moment in time, a lot of people who could be described that way identify or are starting to identify as non-binary. Yeah. Now, that never comes up in the book. So what was that decision as the author?
I wanted to put as few labels in this book as possible.
Right.
Because I wanted it to be as open to interpretation to whoever's hands it was in.
Right.
You can absolutely make the argument that Cassidy is non-binary.
Uh-huh.
She uses female pronouns.
Right.
Right. But that doesn't necessarily mean that she's not non-binary.
Sure. Correct. Totally. So. I'm trying to remember. Is the word butch in the book?
No.
Okay.
Becky.
Gina, who's Cassidy's little friend.
Mohawk friend. Yeah.
She's when Katie's first into her first gay bar.
Uh-huh.
She says, Gina does use butches and femmes.
Yeah.
Oh right. But about Cassidy?
No, just sort of.
Yeah,
that's actually sort of a comic relief line a little bit.
No, totally.
Let the tension out of the room a little bit by just putting it out there and in a way that, you know, it wasn't, that was sort of a tongue in cheek line.
Sure. Yeah, I guess I'm just saying to my recollection, you don't really define Cassidy one way or another besides using she, her pronouns, but otherwise,
Nope. Yeah,
you can kind of assume what you want to about their gender identity, like labels.
Yeah,
yeah,
both of them.
Right. Yeah. So, Alana, do you want to ask about Katie?
Katie, yeah. So, how, when you were creating the character of Katie, how conscious were you of using the female gaze when creating her? And I asked that
Or
the male gaze. I asked exactly where I was going. Because when I was reading about them, I thought, damn, Katie is the girl that we've all grown up seeing as, like, what society deems beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, tall, blonde. I imagined her with big tits. Maybe she didn't. That's my picture.
But the woman that you do see in many rom-coms.
The woman that you see in rom-coms is that, you know?
Yes.
So was that intentional? Was it not? What? Tell me about that. I want to know more.
Yeah, that was intentional. There's a certain level of, you know, aspirational fantasy that I think comes with the rom-com genre that is just fun. It's just pure fun.
Yeah.
So I'm very aware that these characters are sort of types, but if you look a little bit closer, Katie, who's the quote-unquote femme, she actually has all the grit. She's really strong. She's a really strong character. Cassidy, who's the supposed butch, the strong butch, Cassidy is very vain. She's a softie. She's kind of way more emotional than Katie in a lot of ways. You know, she's the one that cares about, you know, her. She's got her $300 haircuts and whatnot. And
there
are a few places where that sort of comes out, I think, in the book. And that's sort of a subversion, you know. But if you're not looking for it, you can easily miss it, and that's fine. People who come to this and, like, are picturing the Nora Ephron-esque, one can easily make the argument that, Katie is, you know, your typical sort of American girl doll, beautiful, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Barbie, sort of, and Cassidy is basically Richard Gere in Pretty Woman or Mr. Big in Sex and the City.
Right.
And I'm fine with that. Like, enjoy that if, you know, there's nothing wrong with those properties.
No, definitely not. I actually envisioned Cassidy as more beautiful, if that makes sense. Like, when I pictured her in my head, like, the way that you write about her, she's so striking. You know what I mean? And that's exactly when you're talking about Cassidy. She's, to me, I was like, she's such a fucking softy. Like, when you start reading about her, you're like, she's coming off tough and there's all these different things, but she's so complex. And that made her more physically beautiful in my mind's eye.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going with that, other than the fact that I love the idea that you gave us room to not just see them at surface value, but like when you start learning more about who they are on the inside, it changes everything.
Yeah. And, you know, the gaze. Yeah. Y, not G-A-Y-S, G-A-Z.
G-A-Z, yeah.
That's part of that, right? Like, yeah, the male gaze as opposed to the female gaze, I mean, we could get into the weeds with how we define those things. But for me, you know, the gaze of this novel and perhaps possibly at some point movie, if the cards fall right.
I hope so.
It's coming from a female gaze or a queer gaze, because these aren't two props, right? They both have humanity. They right. both contain multitudes. They both have contradictions. Neither one of them exists very squarely on one side of a binary.
Yeah.
So that right there blows up like what we traditionally think of as a male gaze story, or a story that's perpetuating.
Yeah.
Dominant stereotypes of gender or sexuality.
100%. Okay, I just had a thought, because part of this podcast is us figuring out what the fuck the female gaze really means,
right,
even, right?
We
okay.
don't know.
Yeah, because we're figuring... So, okay, I think this is a good example. So the character of Katie, if this book were written by a man and there was no agenda about gender sexuality in the book... Then if Katie was a character that was written by that person in that context, then there's a pretty good chance that the reason why she's described as beautiful and femme, et cetera, is because that is the kind of woman that the author likes to write, likes to see, that a male audience likes to read about or watch about or hear about. And it's just kind of the default, right? Like a pretty femme woman, boom. But that's not why you wrote that character that way. You were writing that character because you wanted to set up this dynamic between these two different types of people. You're writing her with intention because we are used to seeing that kind of character, and you want to use that to subvert it in a queer way, right? Like, it wasn't a thoughtless creation of a typical hot femme woman, right? And that is part of the female gaze.
Yes.
It is the intention behind it. It's making a choice for the sake of the story and the audience that you're writing for, not because it's a default to, like, what do straight cis dudes think is hot?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
For one thing, it isn't with the intention just purely to titillate, which I think is
right.
often when we talk about the male gaze, that, like, that's kind of, it's objectification. You're looking
right.
yeah. at something yeah, as yeah. an object. As you were speaking, though, I think the level, like you said, there's a level of intention. There's a level of self-consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is by choice. It's not by accident. It's the difference between camp and kitsch.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Camp.
Yes.
You know, I think, was it Susan Sontag who said camp is basically, you know, you're putting air quotation marks around something, and that, mm-hmm. that's what makes it camp.
Yeah.
There's a knowledge that you're bringing to it, a self-awareness that you're bringing to it. So in the sense of gender, you know, gender as a performance, that's sort of what camp is. Kitsch is like, it's there. That awareness isn't there. Kitsch can be tasteless without the knowledge that it's tasteless,
yes.
right? So like a perfect example is Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump is like a kitsch object. Well, at least he was before he was president.
Only a matter of time.
Sorry. We can cut this out if you want.
No.
But like,
no
Donald Trump with his like golden toilet seats and whatever,
yes.
he doesn't know that he's not campy, because he doesn't have the sense to know that he's tasteless.
Right. He's not in on the joke.
Yes.
He's not in on his own joke.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
There. That sums
good,
it up.
Yeah. You nailed that.
Okay. You mentioned Nora Ephron. And I want to get into all of that. And I feel like a good segue to Nora is if you would read a particular part of the book, which is
after
Katie and Cassidy have had an intimate time together.
You can
no
say
spoilers,
it.
But, okay. you know, it's a rom-com. So at some point, you know, something goes down. Katie talks to Cassidy about what her feelings suddenly are that have sprung up for another woman, and she's trying to understand them and trying to figure out how to articulate them. Sorry, I'll stop describing because the author's sitting here holding the book. Okay. So I'll pass it off to you now.
Like I think you set it up pretty well. I mean, spoiler alert, a little late because you already spoiled it. But been intimate. They've just had sex, and Katie's going over, you know, her feelings, and basically Katie asks Cassidy, you know, did you feel what I felt just now? Did you feel what I felt when that happened? And Cassidy, the softy that she is, puts her hand on Katie's heart and basically says, you know, do you feel what I feel for you right now?
I'm dead.
I know, right?
Don't look at me.
I love to imagine Camille's face writing this.
I know. The fact that she's reading it, I'm just like, fangirl.
Like, what do you tap into?
So Katie just kind of pulls her hand off. Katie pulls Cassidy's hand off her heart, and she says, I'm sorry. Heartbeats freak me out. I don't like the idea of this force pump inside us having to work so hard all the time to keep us alive. Romantic, Cassidy says. I do feel it, though, Katie said. I feel the romance. Does it scare you more or less than having a beating heart? Cassidy asked. Honestly, Katie shook out the rumpled bedspread in search of her undergarments. I thought this weekend was going to be about us becoming better friends, that you were going to say what happened between us last week was just a one-time thing, something we had to get out of the way. And now? Katie located her underwear and slid them on. Did you ever have girlfriends growing up? I mean, friends who were girls, who you were totally obsessed with. And it seemed like no matter how much time you spent together, it was never enough. Katie grabbed Cassidy's chambray button-down from the floor and put it on. You know that high-strung, excitable bond that a girl could only really have with her best girlfriend? Yeah, Cassidy said, I've had that. What happens when all of that gets rolled up into the same person you're sleeping with?
I have full, look at my fucking hair.
Talk about horny.
Chelsea's been horny for a week straight.
I asked you to read that passage because it strikes me as something that is unusual in a rom-com, considering that rom-coms are usually about a straight man and a straight woman. And this moment that happens after they have slept together for the first time, or it's the second time, or whatever it is, there's usually something that happens where the woman has emotions and the man doesn't. And we laugh at the woman for having emotions, and we feel bad for the man who now has to deal with this woman who has emotions all of a sudden, because what the fuck? Like, just chill. We just fucked. Like, you know, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Why are you so obsessed with me? God.
Right. And also because I feel like you describe this in a very relatable way to queer women, that feeling of, well, I don't know. It's a lot of
that things. Feeling of, are you feeling what I'm feeling? And can we talk about it right now instead of playing these fucking games for weeks?
Right. Like, and also, I don't know actually how much you were implying this about what she's saying, but it does remind me of when you start dating women and then all of a sudden you think back to all the girlfriends you had platonically your whole life and mm-hmm. you're like, oh, maybe this is why I was so obsessed with whatever, my best friend, senior year of high school, and I just wanted to sleep in the same bed with her all the time.
We all have that best friend from high school.
Always hold her hand, but it was chill. We were just friends, and then you're like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
So it's kind of all those things in one.
You go back and you reevaluate all of those really intense friendships that you had as an adolescent growing up. Those sleepover nights where you just stay up all night and it's never enough time. I mean, that is exactly what it's like when you start sleeping with, like, a girl that you're dating. It's like the same feeling.
It's the same thing, but you're having sex and it's that, like, emotional, chemical, everything on top of that, like, best friend sleepover, and it's just magical.
Right. So, to bring it back to Nora, our old friend Nora, R.I.P. Nora.
R.I.P.
Let me just state for the record. Nora Ephron is a goddess. And nothing bad will be said about her in my presence, but we can still analyze her work and we can question her work. And you know what? Nora was not perfect. And if she were still alive today in this moment that we're having, I think maybe she would also have some, you know, critical questioning things to say about her own work. Okay. So when Harry Met Sally, she wrote it, but not directed it. Rob Reiner directed it. So we have to keep that in mind when we talk about the gaze that is in that movie. And again, this is another complicated thing. We'll get into the weeds and continually on this podcast. But that passage from your book reminds me of when Harry and Sally sleep together for the first time. And there's that classic scene where they're like lying in bed afterwards. And Sally is just oozing with emotion. I mean, the look on her face is like, I mean, it's one of Meg Ryan's finest moments, right? Of just looking like she is floating in heaven. And then you look at Billy Crystal's face and paralyzed in fear. Paralyzed. And I feel like when you watch that scene, you are supposed to empathize with him. This is my take. I know that ultimately at the end of the film, they seem to find this like thesis they end on when he says to her at the New Year's Eve party, like, you know, basically, I realize that the whole point of being alive is like have what you and I have and to be in love and whatever. And Camille probably remembers the exact quote. Do you?
I don't. Okay. Sorry to let you down.
When you like realize that you found the person you want to spend the rest of your life with, you want the rest of your life to start now or something. Okay. This is very cute and whatever.
Cute.
But I don't think that they were making that argument all the way through. And I think in that scene, and maybe this is because Rob Reiner was directing it, and so it was Nora's beautiful, perfect female gazey script, but a man directing, in that moment, you are laughing at Sally because she is so clueless and she has gone so far beyond what is reasonable after just having had sex with him, and you are like in his skin wanting to get the fuck out of there.
Right.
And so it was such a relief to read in your book this moment where they've like come together and it's amazing and the sex is like everything you wanted them to experience.
Right.
And they both feel good about it afterwards.
Does that happen?
You know, they're on the same page.
Right.
It doesn't create tension between them. Yeah. You know, the sex is not a problem.
I mean, I remember even growing up and literally hearing from my friends that, you know, careful if you have sex with this guy because, you know, they're going to think you're going to get too attached. It was all about emotional part. And you're just like, well, what if I just want to have sex? You know, but the guy's like, oh, she might get emotional. She might get attached because those pheromones. Like,
yeah, okay. That's a good point, actually. It should be said women don't always feel this way after sex.
No, they don't. But also, not even that, but it's just the fear of a woman having an emotion after a moment that is... When two people climax, you can't be upset about that. And if you are, then you need fucking help. You know, like Billy Crystal at the end of that, like you said, if we are supposed to be like feeling from like, oh man, that fucking crazy bitch.
Right, right.
You know, like it makes no sense. And why should an emotional woman be something that scares people or something that we're trained to be scared of?
Right. And the hero is the man who realizes at the end of his long journey that, oh, love is okay. Oh, round of applause. Some of us already knew that, but glad you got there.
Right.
Anyway, so I just think part of this female gaze thing, and this is very prevalent in your book, is just the fact that, well, okay, I guess this isn't entirely true. Cassidy does struggle with feelings.
Cassie definitely struggles with feelings.
Yes. Na, na, na. But I don't feel like you do. Like the author doesn't. The point of view of the book doesn't struggle with feelings. It's like the characters can. But what is the point of the view that the artist is taking? That's what I think makes something the female gaze or not.
Ooh.
Okay.
Just blew my mind just there.
Okay, deep. Shit. Mic drop.
You are the artist, so do you? Yeah. Was that your what was your feelings about emotions? What are your feelings about emotions in your own life, Camille?
Come on, Camille.
We want to zoom out for a second.
I'll start paying you $300 an hour if we begin talking that.
I mean, I'll take it.
I'm gonna speak of the work, and less about my my intention.
Fair. Fair.
Nice writers talking about writing, artists talking about it's just I'm way too populist for that. in the book, in the work, a critical decision was having it be third person close POV alternating chapters. So we get Katie's perspective, we get Cassidy's perspective, we get Katie's, we get Cassidy's. It alternates chapters. It's in the third person, so it's not eyes. Mm-hmm. It's she's. So there's a certain distance there. So you're getting a little bit of a narrative voice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what you're really getting is you're getting Cassidy's exterior through Katie's eyes and Katie's exterior through Cassidy's eyes. Yeah. Right. And you're getting Cassidy's internal thoughts from herself.
Yeah.
And Katie's internal thoughts from herself.
Uh-huh.
So in that sense, the reader gets things that, you know, the reader can see the disconnect between, for example, Cassidy trying to be really tough and hard and performing masculinity in a way that she really kind of fails at.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Katie kind of laughs at her in a lot of ways. But she's trying. She's trying to be so tough. She's trying to have this hard exterior. But we know that the second she meets Katie, she's changed, right? This is the first time she's really falling in love with somebody. She is feeling the feels, and it is freaking her the hell out. She's used to being the one that, like, blows a girl off after a hookup. You know, her conquests are usually just sort of a notch in her belt. But Cassidy's dealing with a lot of stuff. She's aging out. You know, she's 30. She's starting to age out of her lifestyle. She's
still hot.
Nothing not hot about 30.
That's right.
Alana doesn't know that yet.
Shut the fuck up.
You'll know. You'll find out. You know, the bar, their bar, Metropolis, is going to be closing. And so it's forcing her to sort of evolve. And she's dealing with all of these other things beyond the fact that, you know, she's fallen in love with this woman. So there's other things going on for these characters. And I think that the gaze is all about allowing for multiplicity, allowing for contradiction, allowing for humanity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what you were just describing in terms of you're seeing the outside from the opposite and the inside from those people, I think that's what makes that one moment so special, when I think it crosses over when Katie is in Cassidy's closet and Cassidy says that she loves Katie. And that's kind of something that, as a reader, you would have expected Cassidy to think or say to herself, because that's, and just how you describe, that's how we've been learning throughout the book. And in that moment, Katie hears that Cassidy loves her, which is like that, like, she wasn't supposed to, but she did. And I think that, like, that moment when the two cross together is so beautiful, because you're like, oh my God, rom-com.
There it is. Yeah.
That very subtle coming out of the closet.
Yes.
I had to fight for that. We're doing it.
I love that.
So, Camille, now that you have investigated your own gaze as a rom-com creator, how do you feel about the rom-coms that inspired you growing up? Do you think they hold up under the female gaze test?
I think even if we, you know, you mentioned, obviously, goddess Nora Ephron. Uh-huh. You have to take everything in its context. I think if Nora Ephron were...
Historical context?
Historical context, it's the social context. You know, if you look at any movie from the 80s or the 90s, it does not age well right now. It just does not. And that's disturbing, but it's also a sign that we've evolved as a culture, so that's a good thing. It's a good thing that we can look at those and not even necessarily sit down to watch it or watch something with a critical eye, just to watch something purely for entertainment and still, like, not be able to not see it with a critical eye. That's good. That's a good thing.
But Camille, Heartburn?
Heartburn's my favorite book, ever. I love it.
It still holds up.
I've never seen the movie because I won't see it. I don't want to see it because I love the book so much. I know the book by heart.
I love that.
Oh, well, that's fine. I think the movie follows it pretty closely.
Yeah, one day maybe I'll see it.
Okay.
I'm afraid of my...
Don't do it.
My heart burned.
Well, it's gone. I'm like, do I want to spoil the end of Heartburn? It's 30 years old. Okay. Well, guys, watch Heartburn or read it.
Read it first.
Yeah. Read it first. A book written by Nora, which is pretty autobiographical, with some facts and names changed, and then was a film starring Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson, screenplay written by Nora, directed by the great Mike Nichols, who many, I think, would probably say was a fairly female-gazy director, especially for his time. What about Woody Allen?
Oh, God.
Woody.
We're going there?
Only to ask... it's probably impossible to even have this conversation and
that's what we're here for.
Take out the Me Too-iness and everything. But I bring him up because I think about Mike Nichols or someone like Woody Allen, who directed some films, especially earlier in his career, obviously, that had these great roles for women, strong women, inspired a lot of actors and writers and directors. And so even though the auteur we now have thrown into the garbage, I think what remains is a work that does, in a way, feel a bit female gazy and certainly has inspired that in a lot of other people. Do you not? You don't have to touch it if you don't want to.
I don't know. I haven't given it enough thought to speak of it in a way that I think brings anything intellectual to the table.
Okay. That's fair.
I agreed. And I think that's what's so great about this podcast is that I think that a lot of listeners might have something to say, and sometimes not always the people in this room. Like, both Camille and I are like, da. But, you know, if you have an opinion on what Jesse said and you want to contribute and join the conversation, then slide in the DMs.
Yeah. I think Alana's asking you to troll me, is what she's saying. So
troll us.
Bring it on. No, but I don't have a definitive opinion of it. I just, you know, my dog is named Alvy Singer. So Annie Hall has been a very important movie to me my whole life. Okay. And that character, I mean, that character was not the strongest woman, let's be fair. Annie Hall, but was a very unique character, was not in any way the prototype of a woman that we have ever seen in a rom-com. And so I think that movie did do something to further the genre. And that's what I'll say.
And it was of its time. Yeah. I think we all have to look at these, like, even something, even you know,
Great point. You've Got Mail or whatever.
It's of its time. Yeah. It's of its time. And if Nora Ephron was going to make a rom-com, God only, if only she were still making movies, if she was going to make a rom-com right now, it wouldn't be the same. Because the thing that was great about her work was that they were these fun little treats, but they were also sort of mini historical documents of a time. Mm-hmm. They're all very timely.
Yeah.
And they tell a story of a very particular contextual moment. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, Sleepless in Seattle. Any thoughts? Female gaze and Sleepless?
I'm a sucker for these. I fucking love them. It's easy for me to overlook these things sometimes when I'm so invested, because I'm like, literally throw a rom-com at me and I'm like, yes, yes, yes. So I don't...
You turn off that part of
your brain. Off that part. Is that a good thing? Probably not. Maybe it is just to enjoy, but... But I haven't thought about that. So let's give me an example within Sleepless in Seattle that you want me to debate.
Like, was he a man worthy of her love?
Was he a man worthy of her love? Well, is anyone worthy of anyone's love?
Wow. Way to dodge.
Dodge that fucking bullet.
I think it passes. I'll go first. I think it passes. I think... look, Nora also directed. That's a movie that she actually directed, right? And that, I believe, was her, the first movie that she directed. So I think you're very much seeing him through the female gaze, as she was the writer and the director. And it's very much about, listen, like, Meg Ryan hears him on the radio, right? Yeah. We discover her discovering him by kind of, like, hearing him with her, which, well... reminds me of something I want to bring up about A Star Is Born.
Put a pin in that. Put a pin.
Should we just pivot to A Star Is Born? Yes.
I agree that I think it's female gazy, Sleepless in Seattle. And I think the way that the acting, the way that we saw Tom's story was so, I don't know how to fucking say it, female gazy. You know what I mean?
Like, because
it
did. A good dad. It was about being a good dad.
He had feelings that we were able to see.
That's true.
He had feelings that we
very
could,
good point.
And emotions that we could read and digest,
yes.
And he was okay with them.
In fact, she falls in love with him because of the feelings.
You know what I mean? And I think a lot of male characters that we were seeing at the time that those movies were released were the Billy Crystals after having sex with Meg Ryan. We see Tom and we fall in love with him the way that she does because... he has feelings.
Right.
We can see them.
Right.
He's not trying to hide them with his dick.
Yeah.
There it is.
And so also, and You've Got Mail, there's that whole thing about how she can never say the mean thing that she wishes she had said. And then she finally is able to say the, like, dickish thing. And then she feels like shit, which is like, okay, I think that's a good take, right?
Yeah.
Like, being mean and cold-hearted isn't always the answer and definitely doesn't always make you feel better.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So feeling good.
Okay.
I'm feeling good about the Ephron panel.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Now let's pivot.
The movie on everyone's lips. A Star Is Born. Does it embody the female gaze? Directed by a man. Gaga certainly had a lot of influence in that movie, and I think writing the story or fleshing out the characters. I mean, obviously, it's a story that existed in many different iterations before this most recent one. But ultimately, it was Bradley Cooper's movie.
Yeah.
It has always been a very big career vehicle for women, right? It's like been this iconic role that people like Judy Garland and Barbara Streisand have played, and is really about the rise of this woman while this man is falling.
Also, like, damsel in distressness.
Well, right. So I was trying to give it its female gaze props, but on the other hand, yeah, it's about a man rescuing a woman. So I don't know. How do you guys feel?
I think you said this to me, and it stuck with me, because after I watched A Star Is Born, I was like, best fucking movie, blockbuster, seeing it twice, three times, let's go.
Yeah, I'm always good at ruining that for
me. Yeah, you ruined it for me. But you said that the whole movie, you said, do you realize that you were watching the whole movie, you were looking at Gaga through his eyes?
Literally, like, you're literally watching him watch
through
her.
Through his eyes, yeah. And I was like, oh, you're right. Because the story is being told through him. It's about her, and obviously him as well, about their relationship, but through his choices, his eyes, his kind of everything. And she's the damsel in distress, and she runs to him when he... It almost felt like she was such a strong character, but she runs to him every time he's failing, and it's, I don't know, it's, but also that's like a level of toxic relationship-ness that maybe is separate from male and female cases.
Right.
Like, I've been in that fucking relationship
right.
before, you know what I mean? I don't think that's anything to do with anything, yeah. But I do think that it had a very heavy man hand in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that maybe I loved it so much because I'm used to that kind of content growing up, and for me, like, a love story and being saved and rescue me, whether you're Bradley or Cassidy, like, let's go. But I think you ruined it for me when you said that. I think it is not as female gazy as I would have liked. I still enjoyed the movie.
Fair. Oh, yeah. And, like, by the way, we can totally still enjoy male gazy films.
Camila, your eyes, something's going on in your head. What's up?
That wasn't totally my take when I saw it. Maybe just because I find Lady Gaga so much more interesting than Bradley Cooper.
Yes.
I wasn't watching it, and I know he directed it, but the whole time I was watching, from the moment it sort of opens with drag queens, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie, when I saw the trailer, I had zero interest in seeing this movie. I was like, nope, this is going to be, this isn't for me.
Right.
And when I saw the movie, I underestimated Gaga's talent for just across the board being, I think she's a great talent. And I think that, like,
hands
there
down.
Were so many things about that movie, there is no way it came from Bradley Cooper's brain. They are pure Gaga. I mean, you can just see it.
Well,
I could
especially
feel
in that
it.
First half, I think.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And I'm gonna push back that I don't think she's the damsel in distress in this movie at all. I think she's pretty tough. She's a straight talker, she's a straight shooter, and if anything, she's saving him. You know, she's saving him.
Yeah, eventually. I guess just at the beginning, kind of the basic plot of all of these versions of the movie is that he's plucking her out of obscurity. He's giving her her shot at stardom. She would not have this if not for him discovering her. He sees something that no one else has ever seen in her before, at least no one who could give her a shot at a career. I think that's what we were referring to.
Yeah, yeah. But her talent... And the character's talent is there.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is about fame, and it's about love.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I got to say this: it was one of the greatest depictions I think of, like, if anyone who's ever, like, been in love or dated someone who's an active alcoholic or has loved someone who's struggling with addiction. Like, I feel like it really it did a good job with that. So
I have one objection to that.
Okay.
The first time that they have sex, that really bothers me in the movie because he is in the middle of a blackout.
You're right.
Right? And, like, I'm sorry. Like, when you're that fucked up, you don't wake up 2 hours later and, like, a new man ready to have a really connected, romantic, physical experience.
That scene bothered me, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But otherwise, yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. I think my biggest issue with the movie, talking about the gays, is that I never really fell in love with them as a couple.
Oh, I did.
Because I felt like she had so much more going for her than he did. Like,
I know,
he's
but
like
the
an
wrong...
old drunk. Like, what does she love so much besides his fame and the fact that he is putting his attention on her? And then he's like Bradley Cooper looking hot and weathered and like smells like mahogany. Like, I don't know.
I don't think he smelled like mahogany. No. I think he smelled like cigarettes on the
vodka.
Inside of a whiskey bottle.
Yeah. Okay. I think I...
I'm like, oh, it's she has to fall in love with him because it's Bradley Cooper and it's his movie.
I loved their love because it seemed, and maybe this is like the flighty, dreamy girl in me, it seemed like despite all, they could conquer everything. You know what I mean? Like that, to me, I just loved the love that they had, and I don't know if it was, I don't know what it was, but
I felt their connection.
I felt their connection. Yeah. I thought they had chemistry.
They absolutely had chemistry. I think they had beautiful chemistry in the beginning, the way if you're getting involved with someone who you very quickly realize is sort of toxic for you,
yeah.
It can be really invigorating in the beginning, and it's all fun and it's all fast, and you know, she's getting on the bus or the plane, and like, you know, it's all, and then pretty quickly, I mean, we're like a third of the way through the movie when, you know, his true colors come out, and then it's sort of like a codependent horrible nightmare that like toxic. You just feel, I felt sympathy for her through that whole second half.
The Grammy scene.
She's literally is holding him up.
Yeah.
Guys, that scene is absurd. He did not need to piss himself.
He did not need to piss
himself.
That
was melodramatic.
That was the end
of
the movie
for
me.
That was extra.
You guys have really gone out of control.
Well, I think the second half of the movie lost me. There were some parts where my brain started thinking about like, oh, I think I need to pee, or like, should I eat more popcorn? And to me, that's a problem. But it seemed as if there was so much character development. You're investing. And then it's like the storyline about her career. Like, it doesn't really go anywhere other than he's like, you almost want to think, like, is she going to go back to her, quote, roots with him and do the kind and whatever, the music that they used to make?
Right.
And he has a problem with that. And then that whole thing, but she believes in that song about all the asses. Okay, there's that. And then you're trying to follow, like, when he goes to rehab and he has that one, like, 2.5 second conversation where he's like, tried to kill myself once with a belt. And so, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much in the end of the movie that they tried to pack in.
She doesn't have a problem with the popularity and commercialization of her music in the movie. He did.
Yes.
He does. And I think you can apply it to the movie at large. The people who are going to this movie want to go to this movie for the outrageousness of it. They want the melodrama. Melodrama is a plus, not a minus. The people who are drawn to this movie want to eat their popcorn and they want to watch it, and they are not going to be critical when Bradley Cooper pisses himself in that scene because it's like they want this movie to go too far. It's a commercial film. It's a popcorn movie. It's probably going to win a bunch of awards. It's going to be, but you know who, I have a special place in my heart for any work that can straddle that line where it could be commercial and popular and also spark really smart dialogue about the things that we're talking about.
I liked the movie, man.
No, good. Great.
I thought it succeeded in its intentions. I think it did what it... I hear you, Jesse, and I agree with you.
Yeah.
Like if I were going to talk about this, you know, totally critically, like we could absolutely rip it apart. We could rip it to shreds.
Yeah.
But why?
It was fun. The music was good. I was highly entertained.
Me too.
It was like over 2 hours and went by really fast.
Word. I mean, look, I want this podcast ultimately to be a positive place. Gaga's amazing. I wish her all the best. And if she ends up winning an Oscar,
I hope she does.
And Gaga single-handedly made this movie camp and not kitsch.
Yes.
Mm.
She is
full circle,
artist.
Camille. Fucking love when we come full circle. Also, I'm so excited for the When Katie McCassidy Oscar campaign. I hope you'll come back when that
please.
Time comes. And Press I will totally
fingers.
Stand for that movie winning all the Oscars.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Okay, well, guys, just to mention, so we have a wheel that we spin at the end of every episode that has different debate topics on it that we will, in future episodes, be making our guests spin and then randomly have to give us a hot take on a topic. But we had A Star Is Born on the wheel before Camille came in and realized that we definitely wanted to talk to her about that movie. So We forego the spinning of the wheel.
I'm just saying that I'm laughing now because Jessie's talking about the wheel spinning. And as she's saying that, Camille's looking down. We tried to assemble it before this, and it is currently just the actual wheel part.
Listen, with, no one needs to know how the sausage gets made on the
podcast. Literally just a circle, a flat.
I'm really glad I sidestepped the wheel.
There's no way to spin this
thing. Best part of my day.
But we'll assemble
that's
it.
That's the real spoiler of the episode.
Oh, yes.
The wheel is not assembled.
It's a flat thing.
All right. But anyway. Camille, thank you so much for being our first guest.
Fucking rock star.
Thank you for letting me pop the Female Gaze podcast cherry.
Oh, yeah. I like it.
This is a very auspicious beginning for us.
Everyone, please, please read When Katie Met Cassidy. It is a fucking good book. It's a great read. It'll make you happy. It gave me all the feels. So I'm so honored that you're here with us.
Thank you so much.
Such a good book.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Camille. Okay, that's it for today's episode. A huge thank you again to Camille Perry. Be sure to check out her book, When Katie Met Cassidy, available everywhere that you find these crazy antiquated things called books. Or I guess if you're more up to date than I am, you can find it on your Kindle or other digital devices. I don't know.
I think they got it.
It's not even... I like to have physical books because it's like good for my ego. Right, I can look at it and be like, I'm still smart. I still read books. All right, guys, this is the Female Gaze Podcast. Thank you for listening. Now, this is so important. If you enjoyed the show, actually, even if you hated the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes because you can hate subscribe. Hopefully, you're going to love subscribe. Mm-hmm. And also rate and review us on iTunes. We would love to hear what you think on iTunes specifically. That is a way that we can get some traction in iTunes and get more eyeballs or earballs on the show. But of course, we also have social media. Alana, I'll let you take it.
At Female Gaze Pod on Twitter, Instagram. That's all we have for now.
What else is there?
I don't know. We got a Facebook? No. Yeah. But slide in our DMs. Tell us what's up. We want to talk to you. If you have ideas of content that you want us to talk about, if you want to talk about shit with us, just slide in the DM.
That's right. And also, if you want to suggest a topic for our debate wheel.
Oh, yeah.
We don't want to come up with these topics on our own. We want you to give us the topics.
Yeah.
So tweet, DM, whatever, what you think you would like to hear us debate on the show, and we will throw it on the wheel and give you a shout out if we spin on your question.
And
we're also going to be tweeting every episode from our account, so if you could please retweet that, share the episodes with your friends, that'd be much appreciated.
Do it all.
Do
we
it
just
all.
Want to share.
Just share.
The salon is for sharing.
That's right.
And caring.
All right, Gazers, that'll do it for today. We'll see you next week.
See you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.